Hello, world. You're listening to Eleanor Wagner's Strange and Scary World here on the Paranormal UK Radio Network, where we're always creeping it real. I'm your host, Eleanor Wagner.
Historian, teacher, and podcaster. His work has been published in Weird New Jersey Magazine, Military History Quarterly, Military History Magazine, and Honest History Magazine, among others. When not writing, he co-hosts a successful podcast with his best friend titled History Teachers Talking, where they discuss various historical topics in an easy-to-understand and lighthearted manner. Please join me in welcoming Peter Zablocki. Welcome, Peter.
Thank you for having me.
You've written quite a few books, and just to clarify, all of them are true account stories, correct?
Yes. Yeah, I only write history. Yeah, I've been a little busy there for the past couple of years. I think I've written seven books. I published seven books. It will be seven. Next month will be the seventh in 2 years. So it's been a very busy 2 years.
Nice. Well, I'd like to start off our discussion with the 1788 Morristown ghost hoax. It's about a tale that has been recounted in various sensational pamphlets and publications, leaving behind a mystery about what is truth or myth. Can you please explain for the listening audience what this ghostly tale is?
Yeah, so the premise of the story is that it initially started as a tale very reminiscent or similar to like a fable. You know, New Jersey lore, you would compare it to the New Jersey Devil. And the idea is that it kind of gets compiled into a lot of stories of New Jersey. And my goal with this book was to kind of take it out of the realm of fiction and place it back where it belongs, which is a historical account, because this actually transpired. But the premise of the story is that a man by the name of Ransford Rogers, he was from New England, shortly after the Revolutionary War, he travels down to the Morristown, Morris County area in New Jersey. And along with a couple of his conspirators, they come up with a plan where they're going to get a few of the wealthy members of the Morris County and Morristown Society, and they're going to basically scare them into believing that there is a particular ghost that is guarding this treasure. And the treasure, said treasure being the collected treasure of various loyalists and loyalist families from the Revolutionary War period that were supposedly all compiled together by these loyalists to protect their treasure. And they supposedly compiled it all together and they buried it in the Schooley Mountain, which is a remote area, wooded remote area near Morristown. And the belief was there before Ransford Rogers got there. So the belief was that it was already buried there. And supposedly they buried this treasure along with several bodies in order to have spirits guard this treasure. And this kind of was already a story that was going around shortly after the Revolutionary War. So technically ended in 1783. So we're talking, you know, within like 5 years past. He basically just played off of that idea, stating that he had the ability to speak to these spirits. And through that, if they paid him a little bit, he would be able to dispel these spirits and get to that treasure and give it to these other greedy, wealthy, you know, landowners in Morristown. It doesn't really go their way, put it that way. So,
well, you're saying it was a farce.
It was. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, he basically, and it made it very interesting too when you read into this and you realize that he did use some gunpowder to make certain noises. And he did employ somebody else to scare the people that he had with him. But at the end of the day, he used what today, you know, you would almost laugh at and from that perspective. I mean, he would put a white sheet over himself and just stay really far away. You know, and for me, it was very much like, well, maybe because today, you know, we live in a world that a white sheet would no longer cut it, you know.
Right.
I try to figure out when I was doing this research is why would these people believe him? Why would they believe him enough to actually give up their own wealth in order to secure this new treasure? And they did. And that was kind of the idea in the book to take this story and basically build the history around it. While it's always been relegated to just tales, this actually did happen. Ransford Rodgerd was actually trialed in a court in the middle of Morristown on the Green. That courthouse no longer exists. It was like a one single room building. There's evidence of him being trialed. There's evidence of him actually escaping from prison and running away and doing the same exact scam up in New England again. And that time he also escapes, and then kind of history loses him. But my job was, as a historian, to take this story and try to put it in context. What were the superstitions at the time in New Jersey in 1700s, 1780s? What was the belief in the supernatural at that time in New Jersey in 1780s? Why would the people that got essentially conned by this particular Ransford Rodgerd, why were they so afraid of being exposed? Because when this story comes out, it is initially written in a pamphlet form. A pamphlet comes out saying that this is what happened, this is what transpired, these men gave him money. And then this pamphlet that tells the story, which comes out shortly after the events, does not include any names. Supposedly, the very first printing does, and that pamphlet is all bought out by the members of the society in Morristown because they don't want their names to be known in history as people that got duped. So they buy out all those pamphlets. And it's not like today where you could just go and print more kind of thing. You know, this is, you have to contract someone to get the press and get it going. So all the first pamphlets are bought out, and then the history kind of goes away. And about 1820s, another person comes across this pamphlet, supposedly one surviving pamphlet, and he actually rewrites this pamphlet. However, this time around, he takes away all the names of all the members because he said in the pamphlet that a lot of these members are still really prominent members of society. So for me, it was also trying to find those members. Like, who was this? Who were these people? And what was going on in Morristown during this time? How had the war affected Morristown? And really, was there really a treasure? I mean, that was my big thing, right? What is the probability of there being a treasure? The story in itself, when Ransford Rodgerd comes in, he initially gets eight people. He selects eight people and he has them come to his cottage. It's out in, it's kind of in the middle of nowhere. It's on the field or in the field. And he has them, he kind of comes out with these rituals. First, he has somebody outside that's tapping on the windows. And then he has the people kind of walk around in circles from the shortest to tallest and youngest to oldest. And they chant certain things. And then he has them, all right, we're going to meet at Schooley Mountain where I can talk to these spirits. And he takes them there and he actually sets up in the ground, based on at least how it was written, he sets up these little booby traps basically with gunpowder and whatnot. And they kind of explode at certain points and you have smoke coming out. And then that kind of scares people. To them, they're like, well, what is happening? And he was a teacher by profession. And they said he was somewhat of a chemist, Ransford Rodgerd. So he was able to make all these different things happen. And while he's doing this in the woods, scaring them, he has somebody else come out dressed again in basically like a white sheet. And they're further out. And this ghost is saying, you can't get near, only Ransford can get near me. And he goes up and he speaks to this spirit. And then all the men are standing back in the field in the darkness. And he comes back to them and says that the spirit says that you have to each give me this many pounds in order to showcase that you are not just worthy, but willing to go through this. So they basically pay him. And then they're like, well, we'll see you. You know, we'll come back next week and we'll talk to the spirit again. And they do it again. And eventually he kind of gets them going for a while, a certain amount of money, until the guys are starting to get a little aggravated. And they're like, well, where's this treasure? Where's this treasure? Why is he not showing us this treasure? So he kind of bows out before he has his one big grand spectacle, before he gets caught. And he gets them all in and he basically pulls out all the stops. And he himself goes and hides behind a tree and comes out, supposedly as a ghost. And they said he had some kind of mechanism that would alter his voice. And he's speaking with like an amplified voice. And there's smoke everywhere. And there's little explosions coming out because someone's lighting, one of his members of his group is like lighting different gunpowder holes. They made like holes where they put gunpowder into. And he basically scares them in his very last one. And speaking in this spirit's voice, he tells them that they were not worthy. And the time will come, but it is not now. And they should go home and forget that this ever happened. Or the ghost will tell everyone in the town that they were gullible enough and blah, blah, blah. So they all disappear, basically, and just don't talk about it. He sticks around, though, because they don't know it's him. So he's like, I'm so sorry, Kimmel, this happened to us. And then he goes in and basically does it again, also in Morristown. Different members, and the other members are not talking about it because they didn't want to admit to it, so no one really knows. And Ransford, this time around, gets a lot of religious people. And this whole entire news scam, same premise, the loyalists buried their gold 5-6 years prior. They can speak to the spirits, but the spirit is, he kind of took a different approach with these guys because they're extremely religious. And he said, this time the spirit is here due to the fact that it's not at peace. It can't go yet. It needs to protect until it feels like it could give this treasure to some men that are worthy. And he believed that these men need to be religious and they need to believe in God. And only then will the spirit and these spirits rather ascend to heaven. And therefore the treasure will be left to them. So much more of a religious connotation. And, he continues with the scam. And until actually one particular night he gets caught because he winds up drinking. Ransford Rogers winds up drinking a little too much. And he goes to one of his disciples, you might call it, because again, these guys have been given money and they also feel like, where is this treasure? When is it coming? And when he comes in, he's very careless. He tells the man to go out through his house, but he's like, I'm staying by the fence. You can't get close. I'm the spirit. Except it was raining that night. And the wife winds up coming home. And the next morning, she notices a whole lot of footprints. And she's like, okay. And they kind of wind up putting this together. And the wife first, so it's interesting because, at the time in 1780s, women were not allowed to really have education per se, fifth, sixth grade tops. And here are all these supposedly wealthy members of society that are the most intelligent men in Morristown, in Morris County. And it's their wives that figured this out very quickly. So you have the wife basically winds up going to a priest. And the priest comes home to this one particular person who Ransford Rogers saw. And he basically admits like, yes, this is what's been happening. We've been going to this field and we're walking in circles and we're laying down and withholding our hand up in the air. And sometimes it feels like the spirit touches us. And this is kind of considered blasphemy at this point. It's a very religious group of people. And the priest is like, you can't do this. So they wind up actually bringing Ransford Rogers in. He gets arrested. He's put in jail. And as he's awaiting trial in Morristown, one of his constituents believed so strongly that Ransford was correct that he actually helps him escape. He helps him escape from jail. So Ransford Rogers has never really finishes his trial. He escapes. And as he escapes, he moves on and does a very similar thing once more. Up in, I think it was Connecticut or Rhode Island. I don't remember now. And from there, he escapes again. And he's never really heard from again. As for the names of these people that he wind up kind of duping into this, they're lost to history for the most part. So for me, when I got into this story, I'm like, okay, well, let's fill in the gaps. Was there really a treasure? That was my first big question.
And what do you think?
Based on what I found, I don't think there was a treasure.
I don't think so either. I think that was ploy to dupe them, and otherwise he would have kept the treasure for himself. If there was a real treasure, for goodness sake, he wouldn't use it to
absolutely.
Try and, you know what I mean?
Yeah, and if you look at the history of it, and that's kind of that was my thing, it's like I try to build the history around it. There was a possibility, I guess, for a treasure, because there was a lot of loyalists in New Jersey, particularly in Morris County as well. So there is some validity to the fact that these people believed in a treasure, and that stems from the fact that there was really a lot of loyalists in New Jersey during the Revolutionary War. People that were loyal to the crown, people that were considered traitors really to the American cause because they were pro-British. They owned a lot of land. They were often very wealthy Anglican families. And when I started looking into it, you realize that New Jersey had a very much, it was very much like a civil war within a war during the Revolutionary War. And what I mean by that is you had various wealthy families that were Protestant, that really did not get along with these other wealthy Anglican families. And they kind of clashed since like late 1600s, early 1700s. They're clashing. And ultimately, when you have the American Revolutionary War in 1770s, the Anglican group becomes the loyalist group, and your Protestant group becomes the so-called patriots. So these families have actually been fighting with one another for probably 100 years. The Revolutionary War simply gave them almost like a justification to actually take that fight to another level. And every time George Washington came through the area, because he stayed in Morristown twice, every time George Washington came through the area, basically the patriots would rise up and destroy the homes of the wealthy loyalists. They would burn their crops, steal their goods, oftentimes violence. There was deaths and murders. And then when George Washington was on his way out and the British redcoats were coming through, the loyalists would rise up and do exactly the same thing to the patriots. And because New Jersey was very much like a flip-flop state during this, well, colony, I should say, during this war, this happened often, this switching of lines. So these people were killing each other and stealing their own stuff for quite a while. Mm. Now, so the idea here is that that's kind of why the rumor came out during the war. And the rumor came out from the sheer fact that, well, these people, these loyalists were so wealthy before the war. Where's all their stuff? Where's all their stuff? They have to have buried this stuff. But based on my research, all the stuff the loyalists had was already pillaged and stolen during the war. So there really wasn't anything they could have, even if they wanted to hide, because the fight between the loyalists and patriots was so violent and so frequent, changing sides, that the loyalists really suffered in the end. I mean, all their land was repossessed and taken. When the war ended in 83, all the loyalist lands in Morris County and New Jersey were repossessed by the government, and they were given to other families. So there really was nothing left for loyalists to hide. But the greed of the time, it's almost like going back to for the 100 years, well, I hated that family, and I know they had money, they had something, there had to have been something there. So that was my one thing, like possibility of a treasure. And based on what I found, highly likely, if there was any treasure, it was already taken during the war itself.
Right. I'm fascinated by the fact that these people, though, felt that there was an actual ghost. I mean, it kind of likened it a little bit to the Salem witch trials and how they were duped with all of that. All those people were put to death because they were considered witches, because these people actually believed the tale that those young children put out there. And it just seems that they were very gullible when it came to things like that. And they believed in whatever somebody said to them. And this is a perfect example of that. This man was able to tell them that. That's crazy.
Yeah. And that, so that was my second thing in my book. So I broke my book, where half of the book was the tale itself. I basically looked at the old pamphlets and I like reconstructed the tale as it would be told in the various different groupings of stories in New Jersey. And then my second half of the book, I called it historical detection. That's when I was like, all right, why would this happen? Let's build the history around it. So one was the treasure itself, in which I concluded that highly likely never existed. The second thing was the superstitions. Why would these people believe this at this given time? And when I looked into it, while we're living there's definitely a change in late 1700s into more concrete education, per se, there was still a whole lot of superstition in New Jersey in 1700s. You had a tree, there's a couple of trees in New Jersey that were considered haunted by various individuals, and they said that witches would dance around these trees. You would have, I'm just trying to like find the examples when I was looking into it. This is disputed, because this was written by Ben Franklin, and he wrote that in New Jersey, there was a witch trial where they try to drown witches. And again, Ben Franklin supposedly, again, either wrote this based on a real event that happened in New Jersey around this time, or he wrote it to ridicule how gullible some members of the state still were, which is still possible also because of the fact that, as we know, his son was the governor of the state, his son was a loyalist. So Ben Franklin was not necessarily too friendly to New Jersey at the time. But also interesting that he is almost ridiculed in New Jersey, that there is witch trials in New Jersey, that people are hung or hanged, rather, because of the fact that they're considered witches. And this is, you know, late 1700s. When you think of Salem witch trials, that was 1600s. So the fact that this is still happening is interesting. And also medicine-wise, when I was looking into it, back then medicine was more about kind of like witch doctors, country witch doctors, more so than anything else. I was like, well, it's late here and don't move and maybe like drink this tea and walk twice around this room. It was still very much... you know, like they would bring a rock. At one point, I wrote a book, someone would like bring a rock and say, put this rock by your bed and you will feel better tomorrow. There's still that belief. However, there is now also a change in that belief. You have the Enlightenment. You have people really stressing education. In New Jersey, particularly education, when you think of Princeton and universities, most of it dealt with religion. So if you were religious, you actually went to school primarily to become some form of a priest on something that was religious-based. But education is growing, and I think that's also why these men were so embarrassed that they still managed to get duped. And that was the whole, that the world is shifting, but yet they're stuck, and they didn't want to be considered gullible, which is why they really did everything in their power to hush this story up. I mean, they bought out all the pamphlets. They never talked about it. There's histories written of Morris County that were written 60 years later. And some members were still alive, believe it or not, or at least their children. And the guy's writing this story of Morris. This is an official history of Morris County. It's written in 1850s. Yep. And this man is still not talking about the names. He's like, I know the names. This is the unofficial historian. He's commissioned by
the
state to write.
I would love to know who.
Right? And it's like, you know, this is an official historian commissioned by the state of New Jersey to write down history, and he yet still will not name the people. And, you know, and he has a little preface saying that I will not name these people because they're really known men. These guys were embarrassed by it. And I was able to find a couple names. I was able to actually figure a couple names out, which was, I think, to me, this whole process was really fun because I felt like I was doing some detective work, you know, like who are these people?
But you know, it's history, I know, but it's almost like history repeats itself because you're saying all of this stuff and we live in a very gullible world now. We live in a world where people are hearing all sorts of stuff and it just seems like history repeats itself over and over again.
Oh, absolutely. And the idea that, I mean, we could have people that call us and say, your car insurance expiring, or like, this is the IRS.
Yeah.
And people fall for it. People fall
they
for
do.
It.
They do.
Because if they didn't,
it's
these people would not keep on calling.
It's really sad. It's sad.
Yeah.
It is.
So I think that, as you said, this is very much reminiscent of what happened then. People fall for this stuff all the time today. You know, someone calls you and tells you that you need to give them their credit card number. And you're like, oh, okay. And a lot of times when people do get duped, they feel embarrassed. And I think that's really what happened here.
That's what happened. Yeah.
And what really what happened here is, yeah, it caused it to become a fable because of that. Like these men actually did a great job erasing it from history. They clearly had enough money to influence the writers around them to not use their names. And at the same time, because they kind of almost played up this idea that like, oh, yeah, this was all a joke. It was all a joke. It was fake. That's why it winds up in a lot of different stories of New Jersey, like the New Jersey Devil, this idea of like, well, it's a story. It's never actually happened. Meanwhile, I'm like, no, this happened. This is real. This is real. And some of the members I was able to find and locate their names, and there's streets named after them in Morristown today. Like these are, you know, these are some known people. You know, I wrote this book during COVID, like during like the hardcore COVID lockdowns. And I couldn't have done it without the help of different various historical societies and libraries because, you know, I needed a history of Morris County written in 1850s. So I would call the historical society and they're like, okay, we'll leave it for you here. You know, like, okay.
Oh, fine. That's so funny. Yeah.
You know, or like I'll call my local Denville library and I'm like, I need this book. And like, we'll get it for you. And it will like put it in your trunk before like the whole trunk thing became popular.
Oh, that's so nice that they were so accommodating and helpful.
So
that's great.
Yeah, everyone was awesome. The Morris County Historical Society actually let me in to their building. It was so, again, I'm never going to forget it. I asked for the file and again, COVID lockdown. So like, I was given directions on how to enter the building and like I entered the building and there's a room there with a box ready for me just by myself, you know, like, hey, you can look through this stuff. So you're socially distanced, no one's here but you. But, you know, and I held the pamphlet itself, not the one with the names because that one's gone, but the very first one that was written in the early 1800s from which we know this story. I held the actual pamphlet in my hands, which was kind of really cool. Morristown, Morris County Historical Society has so much cool stuff.
All right, I'm curious now, so I got to ask you this question. I know that now you're the vice president of the Denville, New Jersey Historical Society Museum and Research Center, right? As well as one of the town historians. I don't know if you know it, but I write books on true account hauntings in the counties surrounding us. And like you, I'm all about the history. I write about the history of the town, the haunting takes place in, and the history of the building if I can. And then I tell the ghost stories that the residents share with me that they're experiencing. And then if I can get my paranormal team in to do an investigation, then I relay to the reader what we've experienced while we were there. Mm-hmm. So I'm curious what your thoughts are on the paranormal, Peter. Are you a believer or a non-believer? What do you consider real or not real? Do you believe that ghosts exist?
That's a good question. I guess, you know, I never myself experienced paranormal, I guess, occurrence. However, I am also a firm believer that, you know, you can't tell people what to believe. It's almost like when my students, you know, I teach high school and my students ask me things like, well, do you believe in aliens? And it almost seems like they're setting me up for something when they ask that question. Like, do you believe in aliens? But the bottom line is I tell them, well, again, they're 17, 18 years old. They probably are trying to set me up for something. But the idea here is tell them we on Earth have evolved and we have to, we live, obviously, right? Look at us. We're human beings. Mm-hmm. We live on Earth. And the space is huge. I mean, there's so many planets. So who's to say that we are the only ones? What is the likelihood?
I say the same. Exactly.
Right? What is the likelihood that we are the only planet and the entire universe, which is humongous, that was able to do this? And therefore, I tell them, therefore, do I think that there's other life out there? I think so. Yeah, I think there's other life out there. And I think that same thing, you know, when you think of the paranormal, I never experienced anything, but who's to say that there isn't, right? I mean, if some people claim they have, I mean, there's books written about people that talk about, you know, dying for a minute and going to heaven and coming back and witnessing what's going on.
Near-death experiences. I actually wrote about a chapter about that in my last book. I wrote Warren County Hauntings, which came out this last Halloween that passed during COVID. And one of my chapters in the other strange phenomena category is on near-death experiences. I spoke with people who actually died and came back and how it changed their lives, what they saw. Mm-hmm. And how they described it. So, yeah, I mean, you never know what somebody else's experience is. And I actually do a lot of work with local historians in the surrounding counties as well. And I think they've come a long way, too, since, say, 10, 20 years ago. Nobody wanted to talk about the paranormal. People thought they were going to be considered crazy if they said they thought they had a ghost in their house or that they were seeing something or hearing something. So I think now a lot of people have opened up and are openly receptive to the possibility that things can happen. People do sense things. And a lot of the historians are coming around to say, yeah, you know, these old buildings do have history to them that they're alive with. And some of them have stuff going on in them. So I like that a lot of them are receptive now, too, because it just makes a whole new world open up to the paranormal. Yeah.
And again, you know, from a historian's perspective, you know, our job is to dabble in facts. You know, so it makes it very difficult when we have to corroborate various evidence. And I think that might have also played a role in why for the longest time, like you said, maybe historians were a little hesitant to discuss paranormal activity due to the fact that it wasn't something that they could have if they didn't experience it themselves. It's almost like historians need to see it. They need to see it. They need to feel it. They need to read about it. They need to interview somebody. And this thing with this book, it's when I pitched this to my publisher, I'm like, well, it's a ghost book, but it doesn't have a ghost in it. and they were like, okay. I'm like, but it is very much a ghost book.
Sure.
It just in this particular case, the ghost really does not exist. And
not exist. That's right.
It didn't. And perhaps, you know, there is a certain belief that a ghost might have existed. And you can negate the fact that some people believe that. But in this particular case, it didn't. Hence, it's the, you know, 1788 Morristown ghost hoax.
But I love it. I think it's a great story because just the way it's something that you would have expected would have been the way of the world and how somebody who was a dupster would go that route. Like, I get it because he's going to attach himself to their fears, and anything about religion or spirituality or anything of that sort freaked them out. And it was definitely going to end up in his favor, and as it did with so many of those people. So I find that very, very interesting.
I'm curious, like, if this were to happen today, if Ransford Roger lived today, like, what technology, what would he use? You know what I mean? Like, how would he go about this particular con?
I can bet bottom dollar he'd have like hundreds of paranormal teams over there ready to debunk what he was doing and say, you know, they'd all be there with their equipment going, all right, we're going to check this out. And you show us exactly what you're talking about.
That's right.
he would be able to pull the wool over their eyes, I think. But yeah, there is a lot of equipment out there. And he sounds like he was sort of a magician in a way.
He was. Yeah, they said he was a chemist.
Knowledge.
Yeah.
And hey, he might have been one of those world-class magicians that we have nowadays that really do stuff that are unexplainable. And I could see it taking that turn too, that him really being able to do people with magic.
And he did disappear. And there's a couple different sources I looked at believe that the very first pamphlet that came out shortly after, it came out within a year after the events, but people believe he wrote it. They think that he might have written it as to expose the men, because he wound up being thrown in jail ultimately.
You did say that he was helped to escape, and he escaped twice.
By one person. Right. Yeah. But supposedly, you know, some people believe that he would be the only one that would have such good knowledge of what transpired. And because he was educated in a world where many people were not, and he was a school teacher, that potentially he was the one that wrote that pamphlet. You know, this is a rumor. It's another one of those what ifs in history, right?
How long was he incarcerated, Peter? Do you know how long?
Just weeks, and he was out of there. Yeah, okay. It wasn't long at all. I think based on the documents, the court documents, I think he was like a little over a week, and he was out of there. They never even really put him on trial, per se, because they sprung him, which is interesting. You know, and he was held on the green today. You could go there. It's not there anymore, Morristown Green, but a lot of the members, there's a church right on the Morristown Green, and a lot of the members that were part of this are actually buried in the back of that church today, which is really cool. Especially when you think of like, oh, Morristown Ghost, it's a fable. And now I'm like walking around the cemetery and I'm like, oh, no, this is the guy. He was one of the people. It's kind of cool. Like,
neat
bringing history to life.
Yeah, to be able to actually go and find them in where their resting place is and put that theme to one of the ones you discovered in your story.
Yeah. And it feels like too, I mean, like three of my books have a lot of deaths in them and like ghosts and things. I mean, I also wrote a book. The very first book I wrote was Denville 13, which was, sold really well. It was a book about 13 teenagers that killed a man in 1953. And then ultimately the whole story was buried and the town never spoke about it, you know, for 70 years. So that one also has the actual place where that man was killed is still exists. A lot of people don't know how to get to it, but I mean, I do. And then, you know, the other book I wrote also was Terror Over Elizabeth, New Jersey, which was, you know,
those are the two I was going to talk to you about because I'm fascinated.
Was a lot of fun to do. Again, it's such a sad story and such a surreal story. But yeah, what do you want to know about Terror Over Elizabeth?
I think they were great ideas to write for stories. So like for the listeners, the one that he was speaking about, Denville 13th Murder, Redemption and Forgiveness in Small Town, New Jersey. During the summer of 1953, a wealthy traveler with a secret rap sheet as a convicted sex offender arrived in Denville, New Jersey. And this group of 13 local boys ranging in ages from 14 to 22 took it upon themselves to teach this man a lesson and drive him out of town. And that is what that book is about. And then the other, the Terror Over Elizabeth, New Jersey, three airplane crashes in 58 days and the fight for Newark Airport looks like another great read. To fill in the listeners a bit, between December 1951 and January 1952, three separate plane crashes barreled down on Elizabeth, New Jersey. Never knew it. Never had a clue. I never heard about this.
Oh, yeah.
And many dozens perished as these crashes destroyed entire city blocks and wreaked havoc throughout various neighborhoods. I never even knew that. I mean, you hear about crashes and it's once in a blue moon, but this is close to home. This is in Jersey where I live. And I never even knew it. And you say that there was a lot of technological issues that were the reason for the crashes, right? In that particular case?
Yeah, it was, you know, it's, if you put them separately and you look at the investigators' reports, you're like, oh, okay, like this is a fluke. But it, but what you put them three together, you have three huge passenger airplanes taking off or landing in Newark Airport and crashing into within a mile and a half of each other, really, into a neighborhood in Elizabeth, destroying buildings as the way, you know, killing families. It's a family sitting down to eat and boom. I mean, a plane just goes through their living room.
Wow.
To the people who live in Elizabeth, the first time it happened, it was the close. It was actually almost the largest airplane disaster in American history. The only one other one was deadlier that happened a year prior. That was the very first one when they hit into Elizabeth. And the people were like, this is terrible. You know, we need to move the airport out of here. And then the federal government comes in, does an investigation. They're like, well, it was a fluke. It was a little piece that something broke off. You know, what are you going to do kind of thing? Meanwhile, the people in Elizabeth are like, what are you going to do? I mean, we have huge airplanes falling from the sky. Believe it or not, at the time, Newark Airport was so close to Elizabeth. I mean, as close as it is today. But before the new airfield was built that we have there today, which kind of designates the planes and moves the planes away from city centers, back then the planes were going right over city centers. So you're talking like 300 feet in the sky, you had an airplane. It was, you could touch it. Yeah, you feel like you could touch it. You have a humongous airplane that looks like it's just skimming over buildings. And that was the norm. They had this 50
flights. I'm
going
to be honest with you, though. I think about it now. I mean, I think about it. I look up and I see the planes. And when you're in other areas of New Jersey, you can hear them above you a lot closer. It has crossed my mind. Oh, my gosh. What if something happens? It's right there. So,
so
I can only imagine if they were that much closer.
Yeah, this was insane. The first one fell. The bodies were buried all over. I mean, I wrote an article about it actually for Weird New Jersey as well. There was one local man that had, you know, he had a funeral home and it served as the city morgue. And at the time, in the 50s, early 50s, Elizabeth, the guy was never really that busy as a city morgue. You know, he maybe had one body because someone got stabbed somewhere or something along those lines, or someone died in a car crash and the police was investigating. Well, on that particular night, police brought in 50 bodies to him and all various, they're burned, the bodies are burned, they're mutilated. And you know, they're like, well, you're the city morgue, so you got to hold on to it. Well, that house, because he basically did it out of his house. That morgue was a house, it was a bigger home, still stands to this day. You could actually drive by and you're like, how did they fit all these bodies? And they didn't. He wound up basically pulling his cars out of the garage to try to put the bodies in there. And he went and asked his neighbor, like, can you pull your cars? I need your garage. So luckily for them, this was December. It was really cold, but they kept these bodies in their in people's homes, garages, because there's so many. They weren't ready for it. And 2-3 weeks later, another plane crashes and we're back at it. And again, there's all these bodies. And he's like, what is happening? The world is now paying attention to it. And everyone's like, OK, we need to get rid of Newark Airport. This is unsafe. And they're like, no, this is clearly a weird coincidence. And then 2 weeks later, another one crashes. And that's when people are like, okay, like we need to do something about it. And Newark Airport is closed for a little bit. They do wind up reworking it so that way they don't really fly, planes don't really fly over. But the third one is interesting because there was actually survivors in the third plane crash versus the other ones, there is none. And the reason for it is as the plane is coming down, it actually like gets stuck on a tree and it rips the plane in half. And the back of the plane, whoever was in the back of the plane, survives. The plane flips upside down and like falls down. And there's people that survive because of the fact that the tail got stuck on a tree. And, you know, that was a crazy scene because it basically landed in the back of this orphanage. And you had bodies all over the place. And they were still strapped to their seats. I mean, they're burning. And it's just, imagine a scene on a field of just bodies hanging from trees. And these kids from the orphanage actually ran out and they were the first responders to try to, try to save these people, whatever was left of them.
Wow.
Three airplane crashes in 50 days. What are the odds, right? Within the same perimeter, same city. And, you know, once I do research, I tend to write a lot about New Jersey history. And I always come across some little tidbit that I find interesting and I Google it. And if I don't find enough information on it, I'm always like, well, I want to know more. So I have a little whiteboard and I'll write it on a whiteboard. I'm like, I'll come back to you. It's kind of what happened with all my books. You know, it's I'll come back to you. And if I don't find enough information, then I see it as a means or as a way for me to find that information. You know, like, well, if there's no book on it, then I'll write it.
That's so great. I love it. Well, I see that when you're not writing, you co-host a successful podcast with your best friend titled History Teachers Talking, where you discuss various historical topics. My husband mm-hmm. always wanted to be a history teacher, but wound up a high school building trades teacher instead.
That's awesome.
I'm in kindergarten, by the way. So, but kudos to you for teaching kids in today's world, and it's a rough ride. But tell the audience about your podcast, please, and how they can find
it. So the podcast is available everywhere. You can get it on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google. I mean, it's anywhere. It started, my best friend and I, COVID hit, and we kind of missed teaching history. We missed talking about history with our students. He's also a high school history teacher. And we said to ourselves, you know, why don't we just like start a podcast? And he's like, all right. I mean, I guess we could do it. So I ordered a mic and whatever I needed. And we decided we're going to do like a family friendly. So in case our students want to listen to it, since they don't see us anymore because, you know, we're locked down, you know, well, maybe like a different way to reach our students. So we started recording some podcasts and some of our students did start tuning in and then they started emailing us with suggestions and then their parents started emailing us, you know, with suggestions. Mm-hmm. And then after that, it just started growing. I mean, now we have a few thousand subscribers. You know, we have episode downloads in thousands, which is surreal considering that kind of just started as a way to not go cuckoo when we're locked in our rooms during COVID. But yeah, now it's doing great. I mean, we have people that listen to us. Actually, some people listen to us in England. People listen to us in Canada. Some people in Italy listen to us. It's Australia. It's, again, for two New Jersey history teachers, it really took off. And, you know, we enjoy it.
How do you pick your topics? You just randomly pick a topic?
We do. Now we have a lot of suggestions. Mm-hmm. However, for the most part, we're kind of just, I mean, one of our topics was history of cereal. We were literally eating cereal in the morning. I was eating cereal and Tom called. He's like, what are we doing this week? I'm like, I don't know. I'm eating cereal right now. Can I call you back? He goes, yeah, cereal sounds good. I was like, okay. So, you know, we kind of randomly come up with stuff, but now we do have a lot of suggestions. People just email us and they're like, hey, can you guys do this? And we're like, sure, we could do it. Why not? I mean, whatever we don't know.
That's great because a lot of history gets lost in the shuffle and it's not told exactly the way it should be. There are pieces that are left out. And those left out pieces are very important, whether we like them or not. And they should be told no matter what. So I think that's a great opportunity for you guys to do that.
And it's an awesome, you know, it's also a venue to speak and talk about history, and which is cool. I mean, like when sometimes we have different history teachers that we know that we invite on. We're like, hey, you know, it's called history teachers, right? So we're like, we ask our friends to come on. And when Russia invaded Ukraine that night, you know, I got a couple of history teachers together and we got on and we did an episode on invasion, just background, like why would Russia want to invade Ukraine? And that one, you know, went through to 1,000 downloads in like days, like a day or two. It was just, yeah, everyone started talking about it. And actually my local library even made like a little display of like what's going on in Russia. And they put in a little QR code for us. Like, and here's our friendly neighborhood history teacher talking about it. So
that's great. Did you guys do anything on 9/11?
We have done things about terrorism. We have some of the big ones that we want to do parts. So 9/11 will be a couple parts. So we're like planning that out. Holocaust would be a couple parts. Like we have certain topics that are like must do.
That's great.
Just
because they don't really cover Holocaust or 9/11 in schools. I mean, I've not had much time anymore. And it's just like, are you kidding me? I mean, we lived 9/11, so there are not many people that are alive from the Holocaust anymore that we can even speak to. It's great when you have somebody that's a survivor that can actually tell you straight from their heart what happened. And those are few and far between now. So people like you really need to get that word out there and tell everybody exactly what it's about. I think that's great.
That's all.
Well, before we close out the show, Peter, please go ahead and let everyone know how they can find out about you and any upcoming events that you have, your website, that sort of thing.
Awesome. Well, you can find me at just peterzablocki.com. That's Peter and Zablocki. I often tell my students it's Zablocki because, you know, it does have that block word in it. So you can find anything really about my upcoming events on my website. As with regards to my books, I mean, they're, you know, you can buy them on Amazon. You can buy them at Barnes & Noble's. Walmart actually had my books too. So you could really just, you know, you could get them anywhere.
Yeah.
And for the podcast, again, just History Teachers Talking, you could find us, you know, really anywhere. If you Google it, we pop up. So that's pretty much that.
And what are you doing now? What are you working on now?
So I have a book coming out next month called Presidential Visits to New Jersey, a History. I basically was curious. I heard a story that a president visited my town at one point. And then I thought to myself, well, how many other towns have presidents visited New Jersey? And that got me in this rabbit hole of doing research and trying to find every single time that a president came, active president, came to the state of New Jersey, which basically became a book. That was another interesting one, because when I talked to my publisher, just like with the ghost book, I said I want to write a ghost book without a real ghost. I told my my publisher this time, I want to write a political book that's not political. You know, especially, you know, the world we live in today, you know, you don't want to be anything to be misconstrued as something else. And so my idea was, well, let's look at the times when the people of New Jersey celebrated when presidents came to our state. And it wasn't about Republican or Democrat. It was about the office itself and the respect for the office. And it's changed, obviously, a little bit. I mean, you had 250,000 people showed up in Jersey City to see President Roosevelt. That's not going to happen today. The president comes in, you're not probably going to have 250,000 people show up. Again, these numbers are surreal to me. So it definitely changed a little bit. But that's my next book. And I'm currently writing
I'm pretty sure George Washington came to Sussex, New Jersey, if I remember.
Yeah, correctly. So George Washington came. He kind of visited a lot of these places during the Revolutionary War. So that was the little caveat. I had to say, I'm only going to concentrate on when it was a sitting president. So not after or before they were president. Like, for example, Herbert Hoover, who was known as one of the worst presidents in American history, after he stopped being president, him and his wife kind of got in the car and he just went across America, just kind of obscure. But he visited New Jersey and went fishing in New Jersey. So, okay. So like fun tidbits, cool stories. But I kind of wanted to concentrate more on when they were the president. You had President Truman came to Paramus, New Jersey, because his daughter was an aspiring actress. So she had a show. So he came to a show as a former president. And everyone's like, oh, you know, you want to talk to us, Mr. President? He's like, no, I'm here to see my daughter sing and star in this play. I'm not talking about anything. So it was fun. It was fun history, fun doing research. And I'm taking a little break from New Jersey. I'm currently writing a book about the potential assassination of the Polish prime minister in World War II, which is kind of like a conspiracy theory book, you know, about a topic in World War II that's close to home because I was born in Poland and both my grandfathers fought in World War II for the Polish army. There's a story in Poland that the Polish prime minister's airplane, which crashed, might have potentially been assassinated by Winston Churchill. So I'm kind of looking into that. So that's a
Sounds interesting. Much luck in your endeavors. I hope it goes good for you.
Awesome.
And thank you so much for joining me tonight. This was great. I really enjoyed talking to you.
Thank you so much for having me.
And for the listeners, if you liked listening to this week's episode and you're into all things paranormal, check out my other show, Eleanor Wagner's Creepin' It Real podcast out of the Coast to Coast Entertainment Network, which is available wherever you get your podcast and streamed through my YouTube, Eleanor Wagner. And if you're interested in reading any of my books, you can find the links to them on my website, authoreleanorwagner.com.
Ghostly listeners, you can follow me on my website, authoreleanorwagner.com, where there are links to my books and video updates and photographs from all the investigations. Thank you, paranormal enthusiasts, for tuning in today. I hope you'll come back again. Remember to tap into your own gifts. Everyone has them. And in the meantime, make sure you're creeping it real.